Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. This is Richard's fault. Richard Dugan, our producer. It's his fault totally. He thought I would be interested in a particular author who has studied and written at least four books on various artists who painted on velvet. And little did he know, Richard... Little did Richard know that I grew up this way, and I'll tell you, we have with us C.J. Cook, who we're going to talk about. He's an author. He's in California, Southern California, and he's done a number of books on painters who actually paint on velvet, and I think it's fantastic. It's just a really interesting, quirky style, and we're going to talk with C.J. about that. But my background... with this sort of genre, if you can call it a genre, is that my mom, bless her heart, she had certain kind of tastes in art, and her taste in art ran to those sorts of, paintings on velvet that were accentuated by the ladies at the church with little glitter and stones and mosaics. And in my bathroom, the kids' bathroom, she did hung up a painting on velvet of frogs that was done, you know, with these little glitter eyes and sand and stuff like this, you know. I never really understood my mom's taste in art that way. She either liked that kind of thing or she liked things that were incredibly realistic looking. It could have been photographs on the wall. And there was nothing in between, you know. So that was me growing up in a farm town in Illinois with the paintings on velvet. And here Richard thought, okay, wouldn't this be interesting to talk with C.J. Cook, who has made a career of studying specific works on velvet. I want to introduce CJ to the show, and his book just won gold medal for book award for best biography. And this is about Edgar Letteg, and it is, everybody will recognize this once they see it. The artist did Polynesian beauties, Polynesian pool boys, I guess you could call them physique-wise. And they're quite good. I mean, they're quite, but they're very stylized. And I'm interested to know how CJ found his calling. And anyway, welcome to the show, CJ. Enough
Thank
about
you.
My mother's. Yes. I know. Okay, Richard. Okay, Richard is showing us a half-naked. That's a Native American woman on velvet, and yes. And where did you find that, Richard?
Do you know that it's followed me probably since my early 20s, from Phoenix to Santa Barbara to Twin Peaks? I have no clue as to why, other than I liked the way that she looked, and the black velvet intrigued me back then.
Okay, so that's a young man's, yeah, fantasy, and likewise.
Yeah, okay.
And likewise, I mean, some of the works that I was looking at in Letteg's oeuvre.
Letteg's
oeuvre, yeah, are very similar, you know, very voluptuous, very interesting-looking female Polynesian beauties with the flower behind the ear and the flowing hair, et cetera. So do tell me, CJ, how did you discover your calling?
Well, I don't know if it's my calling, but I bought a painting by Ralph Burke Tyree probably 20 years ago in Honolulu. and just fell in love with both the painting. It was just exquisite, and this kind of genre. Oil. These are oil paints on velvet.
Yes.
And Tyree was probably the best. And so I wrote my first book on Ralph Burke Tyree, Artist of the South Pacific, and then did a follow-up of his animals. He did a lot of animals too, which were pretty photorealistic, as you were alluding to. But the guy that started it all was Edgar Leetag out of Tahiti, who's an American who went down there with his mama, Bertha, in 1933, and for the next 20 years became famous doing his black velvets and really started this whole Polynesian genre of oil paintings on black velvet. And both he and Tyree made a living of their paintings, but they're two different gentlemen. Tyree was a former Marine, a good guy, seven kids, a wife, was just a nice, loyal person. Leetag was just the opposite. He was a wild and crazy rascal who would go to bars in Tahiti, Papeete, Quinn's Bar, most famously, and find his models that he would shuffle back over to Morea, which is a neighboring island, to his Villa Valor estate, where they would be housed with his mama and some kids and so on. And that's where he painted. He was 20 years before the Playboy Mansion. He had his own mansion right on the water and a poolside bar and so on and so forth. So he was quite ahead of his time.
Did you say Villa Valor?
Yeah, that was the name of his estate. Yep.
Oh, God. Okay, Richard, we got a name for your cabin.
I love that.
Oh, Villa, that's fantastic. Valor. Via Valor.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You got to have big signs, though. He had a big sign over the bathroom that named it. So you'll have to. He had a bunch of buildings. He and his mother built them themselves. And so it was quite an estate. It was five or six cabins. And so he'd have his guests come, and freeloaders would stay, and he would paint and have fun.
Now, who would stay?
Just people. You know, friends would come by and stay, and sometimes people that didn't even want to stay would stay. Tourists would come by. Can we stay and drink with you? And he was a pretty nice guy, and he'd let them do that for a while, and then he'd kick them out. But most of it was for his wife and or his girlfriends and his mother.
So he never married. He never had kids. He never had a family.
He had kids. In fact, I met with his youngest child, who is my age now, but he was three when his daddy died. But he had three kids that we know of, and he married once officially, and once he had a live-in gal named Jackie that lived with him during the war, World War II, for about 4 years, and they produced two kids that stayed with Edgar.
So, I just want to fit this into the genre because, you know, CJ, I'm an appraiser, and I like to study material culture. That's my bag. And So when I'm thinking of paintings on velvet of Polynesian women, et cetera, and I'm listening to your story, and I'm hearing about Via Valor, Leetag's. Leetag's mansion, Playboy Mansion, before Playboy Mansions were invented, Via Valor, where he'd have his lair and his paintbrushes and his oils, and he'd do his beautiful South Pacific women paintings. And I'm thinking, okay, how does this fit into tiki culture? Because the tiki culture, when I was growing up, we had in Chicago... Was it a restaurant that was all tiki themed? And I forget what it was called, but, you know, there was all tiki and a lot of paintings on velvet and tiki torches and those funny canoes hanging from the ceilings. Do you know the name of that restaurant I'm talking about?
I don't, not in Chicago. Trader Vic's is the most famous.
Yeah, Trader Vic's. That was it. Yeah, that was it.
And we had a Trader Vic's. Don the Beachcomber was another one.
Don the Beachcomber. Yep. We've got that. Yeah. So but how they does all that...
came. Well, they all came after. I mean, he started his paintings was this was before the war, World War II, and then the war was actually the Americans took over Bora Bora of all places to protect Tahiti from the Japanese, and so there's a lot of troops there that would come and buy his paintings, which were pretty cheap at that time. And gradually that got out to the public because the sailors would take them back home. And then came the restaurants that idolized the South Pacific, Tropiques in Honolulu, the Trader Vic's, and Don the Beachcomber came in later. They want the dark and mystic. So they would go there and buy his black velvets for their restaurants because it fit their genre, their taste in the dark, you know, room with a little bit of light on because they need a lot of light. But it can be almost fluorescent or whatever you want. So they would buy him from, and that started to, you know, make him a rich man. He was a very rich artist during his lifetime because his agent, Barney Davis in Honolulu, really jacked the prices up, and he was getting.
You're talking about Lee Tag.
Yes, yeah, Lee Tag. Yeah, he was getting $500 to $1,000 a painting, which back in 1940 was a lot of money. And so he was a pretty wealthy man that allowed him to buy all his land there in Morea and to have his lifestyle to do what he wanted to do. There weren't too many artists that was making that much money at that time.
Okay. Will you tell me? Go ahead.
Well, his paintings are, you know, they're worth, you know, $3,000 to $5,000, if not more. Tyree's the same, if they're a pretty woman. They've held their value very nicely because they're well done. They're oils that they have to penetrate the velvet to stay. They're not acrylics on the surface. They're not smudged on. They're very dilute oils that have to go through the fiber of the velvet to get there and remain. He learned how to do it well, and so did Tyree. Neither one worked together. Tyree came after him, but learned how to do the process.
Okay, so Tyree was first or second to actually?
He was afterwards. He was 10 years later. Yeah.
Okay, so Lee Tag was actually
number one. He's the father of black velvet painting. He's the guy.
Okay, and your book is called Lee Tag: Babes, Bars, Beaches, and Black Velvet Art.
You got it.
That's a fantastic title. And now Lee Tag left California. Where in California? He left in 1933.
Sacramento. He was he painted signs, roadside billboards. He was really good. He could take a photograph, which carried over into his art. He could take a photograph that they gave him of some scene of a tractor mowing or whatever, and put it up on the billboard without any measurements or anything. He could just translate that to a size of a billboard. So he worked for the biggest, best billboard company in America, and the highways are coming. So he was very, very good at what he did. And they gave him an award to prize because of his excellence to go anywhere he wanted. And he picked Tahiti and went down there in 1930 as a temporary trip, loved it, and said, I'm going to go back there and live full time. His mother, who had lost her husband when Lee Tag was quite young, had been following him around everywhere. So she went with him. Didn't like the girls that he hung out with, but liked her son, so she would hang around with him and outlived him, actually. So Bertha is her name. Quite a story.
So, and he made this Villa Velour, his home in Tahiti. Yep. And he painted and he drank and he partied, and he became a fixture of the South Pacific art scene. And tourists would seek him out for his wine and women and song. And I don't completely understand. He was also a critic of some kind.
Well, he took on the Honolulu Academy of Arts had shows, and he'd go to Honolulu, which is 2,500 miles away, but he could get more for his paintings. So he'd go there frequently. And they had a big battle because he and some of his friends, which were really good artists, got in a fight with the Honolulu Academy on being squeezed out of some of their exhibits. And so he did letters. He was a very clever writer. So he would, even though he was just a high school graduate, he was funny. And he would write letters to the editor and just criticize the art society there and pick on him. And then he'd go back to Tahiti. But he was, he'd work hard. He'd paint, and then every 2 weeks he'd go to Papeete, to the wharf, and have fun. He'd, you know, he'd pick up some paintings, send some off to Honolulu, and they would all be rolled up sent by mail. And then his agent would frame them up, and then he'd sell them to tourists. But he worked hard and just produced. Probably the biggest thing is he had a patron who was a Mormon jeweler, and his Mormon jeweler and his wife came by and loved their black velvet paintings. And for the next 10 years, he produced one a month for this Mormon jeweler named Decker. He and his wife just collected them. And when Liteg died, Decker had more than 200 of his paintings. And so the irony of it is that after Decker died, he gave them to the Mormon church in Honolulu, and they were the biggest owners of black velvet nudes in the world. So that's kind of the ending of the story a little bit, or maybe the beginning.
Can you believe that? Oh, Richard, are you hearing this? I mean, you couldn't invent this. This is like so here's a guy boozing it up in the 30s and the 40s in Tahiti. His mom is clucking after him. Yep. He's painting nude women. And then he'd take a break every 2 weeks and go down and really get hammered. And then he'd come back and paint more. And his agent, Barney, hooked him up with a Mormon.
No, the Mormon found him himself. They were on a cruise, and they saw his paintings for sale on the wharf in Papeete. And his wife even loved him. And so they said, "We love these paintings. We want more." And they all were naked girls that he bought. And then he painted their family and everybody else, too. He was his patron. Decker was before Barney, even. He gave him the money to be a star, because he was paying him big dollars for him to produce paintings every month.
So this Mormon guy, when he died, he left 200 to 300 paintings to the Mormon church in Honolulu. Yep. And therefore the Mormon church was the largest owner of naked women on velvet.
Yes. Back a little bit ago, they probably have sold some of them. I know they've sold half of them to some people after that, but they, at the time he died, yes. Correct.
I can't believe that. That's stranger than fiction.
They still have a bunch there, but I have never seen them, heard about them exhibiting them. So.
No, they're not going to exhibit those, I don't think. But were you allowed to go see them?
No, I didn't try, actually.
No, okay, yeah, okay. I did. So he was a pioneer. So now we've established that this Edgar Liteg in the 30s was a pioneer in the South Pacific of naked women on black velvet. And your book is called Liteg, Babes, Bars, Beaches, and Black Velvet Art, tells the story of this larger-than-life creative individual who was a thriving artist, not a starving artist, but a thriving artist. Yeah.
And there's a book by James Michener, the famous author.
Yeah.
Michener went to Quinn's Bar and met Liteg back in the late 1940s. And then Michener wrote a book called Rascals in Paradise, true stories about 10 rascals in Paradise, which you should get. It's a great read. And the last chapter is called Liteg, the Legend. And Michener just describes this character beautifully and helped to make his fame even more so after his death. He published a book in 57. Liteg died in 53, so it was 4 years after he died, but it came out. But it's a good book, and it added to the lore of the magical, crazy guy, the rascal in paradise, Edgar Liteg.
I think that's amazing. And when Richard's giving us time, we got to go to a quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to talk about the resilient Hawaiian artist, and we're going to talk a little bit about Edith, am I pronounced Edith Bueller?
Bueller, yep.
Okay, I want to talk about her too. And I just want to couch this, Richard. You know, I want to put this into context, because if you're thinking about, like, you showed me your Native American half-naked woman on velvet there. Okay, that's in your cabin up at Twin Pines, and that she's very voluptuous and beautiful, et cetera. And she's in color. Mm-hmm. Now, what you have to realize, there was no color really before 1942. I mean, artists could paint in color, but as far as the common man seeing the world in color, until films adopted color in 1942, you didn't have much color as a common man, you know, so as far as common man or woman. So that these paintings, you know, we're talking about the 30s here, with vivid colors, because that black velvet, when it goes into the fabric, it sort of pops the color. You know, it's, color is a big deal in these pieces. So it's you know, when CJ's talking about the Mormon benefactor passing the wharf and Pompeo saying, I got to be your patron and paint me as many nude women as you can, that kind of thing.
Too much, huh?
It's amazing, CJ. All right, we'll go to a quick break, you know, from the sublime to the sublime. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about a female in the genre of Rascals in Paradise, as we're talking about. And I also want to talk about Tyree, because I have heard of him and I have seen some of Tyree's work. And he's kind of a different kettle of fish altogether, because he's sort of the G.I. Joe of the group. I just want to give another shout out. C.J. Cook, I mean, this is number four. The book is Lee Tag, Babes, Bars, Beaches, and Black Velvet Art. And then he also wrote a book, Edith Beutler, Beautifying Hawaii with Color. And then another book, Beauty and the Beast, Flora, Fauna, and Endangered Species, of artist Ralph Burke Tyree. And also Tyree, Artist of the South Pacific. So,
and I got a fifth one coming out about Robert Lee Estridge, who's a watercolorist that's going to come out this summer. It's done. The printers has it, and you'll see it in the summertime. Another fellow who painted in Hawaii and Tahiti, but more traditional on canvas and paper, watercolors and other. That's sort of my genre of these lesser known artists of the South Pacific.
So I got to say, you also, CJ, you collect as well. So you have a connoisseur's eye for these sorts of paintings, and you collect Tyree and Lee Tag and Edith Beutler, CeCe Rodriguez, Robert Lee Eskridge, William Bloom, and Madge Tennant. And I got to say, this is where our paths cross. I'll have to dig out. When we go to a quick break, I'll go and I have four or five works of Madge Tennant's. And I had a friend who was this is another one. It's almost as rich as the Mormon collecting South Pacific naked women on velvet. This friend of mine was one of these people that was kind of a shady character, and he'd go and buy storage lockers that were late on their payments.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought a storage locker and he sold me a bunch of stuff from that storage locker. I didn't know that that's how he obtained Madge Tennant's. I have her entire sketchbook.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's cool. It's original stuff, not prints.
Oh, these
nice.
Yeah. And I didn't know much about her until somebody said, I think it was a friend of mine from Bonhams said, Hawaiiana is a big deal right now. Mm-hmm. Who do you know of your clients who own Hawaiiana? And I said, well, I don't really know anybody who owns Hawaiiana. And I started to look at my, you know, I've been appraising for 30 some odd years. And I started to look back at my records and I thought, oh, yeah, I do know some people that collected, that lived on Hawaii, you know, fairly early on in their careers. And they collected in the 60s, and that work now is big. It's big money. And but I mean, I'm not talking about the paintings on velvet necessarily. I'm talking because Madge Tennant's a whole different kind of artist.
Wow, Lee Tag knew her well and didn't like her because she didn't like the way she did her drawings. He likes more realistic stuff, and he was part of the group that he got in a fight with because she was judging her own paintings, and that was the genesis of that battle in 1938 with Madge Tennant and others from the Academy.
What did you call the battle?
Well, it was a artist battle. They formed two groups that were led by Lee Tag criticizing the Academy and how they were choosing the artists. And some very prominent artists were on Lee Tag's side fighting against Madge Tennant and Norris and others that were with the Academy. And so they ended up dividing into two groups and had a newspaper battle, let's call it that, much and set up two societies because of it. But it was instigated by Lee Tag charging after him.
I think that's fantastic. Okay.
It's in the book. Richard, if you look at that chapter, you'll find it.
Richard, I thank you very much for introducing me to CJ because this is just too rich for any imagination could possibly cook up. Oh. And I'm going to run to my bedroom. I've got four pieces by Madge Tennant, and
sure.
I'm going to drag her out to show CJ. And Richard's going to give us a quick break. And when we get back from the break, we're going to talk about a couple more artists who painted on velvet. And one of those artists is actually what we call an animalier, Tyree. And I think I've seen one of his tigers, maybe.
My cover is a tiger, but we'll go do your break and we can talk about
okay,
it.
Okay. All right. Well, don't turn that down. Back with CJ Cook. We're talking about Babes on Black Velvet, CJ's latest book. Is forthcoming this summer, but his book that's out now is Lee Tag, Babes, Bars, Beaches, and Black Velvet Art, the story of Edgar Lee Tag, an American who moved to Polynesia in the 1930s and painted beautiful Polynesian women in the nude on black velvet. Unbelievable stories that we're getting into this hour, and it's all Richard Dugan's fault. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Elizabeth Stewart and Richard Dugan found out about an author who we're interviewing right now, CJ Cook, and said, "Oh, Elizabeth, I think we should do a segment with CJ because he's an expert on oil paintings on black velvet." And Richard thought this was right up my alley, and indeed, there's some of these stories are amazing. CJ is an award-winning author and historian. He's been interested in the South Pacific forever. His first book is Tyree, Artist of the South Pacific in 2017. It won two gold awards for best cover, best biography, et cetera, et cetera. And his second book, Lee Tag, Babes, Bars, Beaches, and Black Velvet Art, gold medal for best biography, et cetera. In 2023, he released a sequel, Beauty in the Beast, Flora, Fauna, and the Endangered Species of artist Ralph Burke Tyree. And this work expanded on Tyree's themes of legacy and animals, et cetera. And then I want to talk a bit about Ralph Burke Tyree. And also, his fourth book is Edith Beutler, Beautifying Hawaii with Color in 2025. She was the foremost colorist in Hawaii, painting black and white prints before color photography was available. So maybe let's talk a little bit about that female artist. Tell me how you discovered her, CJ.
It's Edith Beutler. She was actually a colorist. And a colorist, as you alluded to before, there wasn't any colored film. And so before colored film came to be in the late 1940s, they would have colorists paint black and white with oil, light oil paints. And I started collecting her works. I bought a big collection of her stuff. And so I had a lot of her paintings. And it's a light oil painting on a blown up black and white photo, mostly flowers, some scenery. And I had a lot of her. I had like 100 of her paintings. But I didn't know anything about her story. I just couldn't find it in the newspaper. Well, her daughter was a silent movie star. And I tracked her down, and her son wrote a book about his mother. And he lived with his grandmother, which was Edith. And so we've never met personally. He lives in New York and I live in San Diego, and we cross-fertilized. I had the art and he had the story, and we put that together in about 6 months' time. So she was the best colorist in the United States. She worked for the University of California doing lantern slides, and she worked for the East Coast universities like Harvard. She went to work for Hollywood, but it was during the Depression she got fired. So Kodak picks up her and says, "We're trying to teach the public how to colorize black and white. Come to Hawaii and we'll take care of you there and help you get your own shops." And she was quite an entrepreneur. She had already had her own colorist studio. So she goes there by herself and basically teaches the public, educates the public, and then starts colorizing a very known, well-known photographer's black and white images, and makes a living. Actually opens up three colorized art shops that Kodak helps sponsor. And it's quite a story, because but at the same time they're hiring her, they're developing color film that put her out of business about 15 years later. But this tough little entrepreneur lady who had her own business and actually opened her first shop 3 months after Pearl Harbor attack. So she was there for the attack, and then opened her own colorizing studio, got her son involved, her daughter involved, and so on and so forth. But she did a good job. She was quite a fireball, a really inspirational lady, an entrepreneur, and a very talented lady. With, if you look at her art is quite good. She does more than, you know, just paint over it. It's the best. You can't find any other colorists in the United States that I've ever seen do a better job than what she did.
Can you tell the difference between her work, let's say, and Kodachrome, the late, you know, in other words, can you say, because, for example, when I think of a colorist, I think of somebody, for example, in 1880 who took an ancestor photograph done, you know, in a silver gelatin photograph, and then this colorist would paint over the photo. And you can really see the pedimento of the photo underneath the color.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, what's the telltale mark of a colorist's work?
I think it's the detail. There were many colorists, some of the photographers who do their own coloring in the early 1900s. But she came along, and every little leaf, every little branch of a palm tree is hand-painted with a little teeny cotton on a stick, basically, not a brush even. And she would just, it was very meticulous work. Yeah, you, there's no comparison when you see them side by side. Actually, in the book, I compared to one of the best photographed colorists and her work, and you'll see it in that chapter where how she did it. So she was remarkable. She was really, really good.
But how can you tell that it's not an image from a color negative?
Oh, because the quality is so much better. It's rich. It doesn't go away. It's oil painting. So you don't even have to put it under glass if you don't want to, because it's an oil painting, basically. So the glass is just protective so somebody doesn't scratch it or something, but it isn't going to fade because it's oil. And light,
so
very, very, very dilute. Yeah, you would see it side by side. And the early colored film wasn't very good, and they fade. You know, if you look at your pictures from the 60s, they're fading away. If you don't get them scanned and into your computer, they're gone. Your pictures are gone. Black and white will stay, but not the color in those days.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, I understand that now. And so she lived in Hawaii most of her life, is that right?
Yes. Yep. Until she had a stroke. She actually worked until she was 83, and then she had a stroke. And they brought her back to California with her son to take care of her in a nursing home, and she passed away. But she was a hardworking lady, literally was a sales lady from age 63 to 83 in a place where they sold koa wood furniture and bowls and things like that. They loved her because she was such a great sales lady. So she worked for 20 more years. But she was quite wealthy. She did quite well. She had her own house. When she was there, she was buy her own car. She was a success. An entrepreneur lady was success because she was very, very good. The best.
That's fantastic. It's wonderful that you discovered her. All right. Now tell us a little bit about Tyree and Ralph Berg Tyree. He's a World War II U.S. Marine. He became an iconic artist of the tiki aesthetic. Tell us about him.
Well, he was 10 years after Lee Tag and knew about Lee Tag, but he started out as a Marine and signed up in San Diego. He signed up 6 weeks after Pearl Harbor, came down to San Diego to train and got shipped to Samoa. But he had had a lot of art training, even worked for Walt Disney, doing background scenes and stuff before the war. The commander in Samoa, the American commander, found out he was an artist and he was an infantry man. They pulled him off the front lines so he didn't have to hit the beaches of Iwo Jima or something, and became the artist for the command posts there. So he would do their menus. He did murals on the walls to make everybody happy of hula girls and so on and so forth. Would then paint all the loved ones of the generals to do paintings so they could send back oils for their spouses and girlfriends back home while he was there. The commander liked him, brought him back to San Diego when he left in 1944, and he started his career, married his high school sweetheart named Margot, and they produced seven kids, six boys and one girl. And his story wasn't out there until I bought that painting. And then this was more being a newspaper reporter. I went to interview every one of the kids to learn about their daddy. He had died of a heart attack way back in 1979. So he was gone, but his wife was still alive and 92 at that time. And they allowed me to take pictures of all their art and her letters from him, which were paintings, actually. And all those are in the book to tell his story. He was a really nice guy, tough, quiet artist that just loved to paint and, again, survived. He wasn't as wealthy. He never became as wealthy as Lee Tag, because he was a quiet guy and just would do his thing. But he survived painting
How long was he in the South Pacific?
Well, he'd come back and forth. He was in California and then he'd go 2 years in Guam, or he'd go 2 years in the various islands of Hawaii. And he never had a house. So they'd take the whole family and all move together to someplace in Hawaii, Oahu, Maui, and whatever, and stay there for 2 years, paint animals or paint people, both men and women. And he started initially, he was all oils on board and oils on canvas. And then because of the popularity of black velvet, he switched in 1960 to black velvet because, as you alluded to, he could sell it to the tiki bars, which were now getting going, both in Trader Vic's and places like that, and as well as in California, all the various restaurants that were into the Pacific tiki scene. So he had many sources to sell to, and that's where he was. But they were cheap, $25 a piece. Now you're talking, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 if you find them. And he's in California. You'll probably run across them. As you mentioned, you've ran across some of his animals. So yeah. You'll see them because that's what he mostly painted between Hawaii and later in his life and California.
So he actually left the Marines and he was painting independently of the Marines.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So it wasn't.
Yeah, after 1946, he was. Yeah. When the war was over. He left the military. He worked for the military in Guam, but as doing geographic maps and things like that, and then set up his own private studio. But he was a civilian at that time.
And you mentioned that this sort of that the five books now, the fifth one coming out this summer on this topics very similar artists of sort of the tiki culture. But did you mention you have a journalist background?
No, I've written quite a bit, but not as a journalist. No.
Well, what's your background?
Medical field. I was in the medical field, so I did a lot of writing in the medical field, but this is completely away from that. And I'd done the historical things, vignettes on famous doctors, but not a book of this type. So just let's switch fields, do something different. But it's all science. Digging out stuff is curiosity and science, and go find the answer.
I get it.
Okay, go find the answer. Go get it. And it's easier nowadays because of, you know, the internet and Ancestry and newspaper.com and so on and so forth. You can dig out the stories about people.
So, Richard, do we have we go to quick break, do we have like a little bit, 5 minute time? I want to talk a little bit about Tyree's animals and some of the exotic species. So we'll go to quick break and then we'll talk a little bit and finish the interview with Ralph Burke Tyree and his animals. Very rare, some of the animal species that he painted. A prolific artist. And this is also a book that was written by C.J. Cook about the Beauty and the Beast, the artwork of Ralph Burke Tyree and the endangered species. So we'll talk about that when we get back from the break. And like I said, this interview is all Richard Dugan's fault because he thought I would be interested in interviewing C.J. Cook, who is an award-winning author and historian with a long interest in the history of the South Pacific and works by tiki artists on velvet. Fantastic and niche, but really interesting cultural history. When we get back from the break, we're going to talk about the animals on black velvet. We're going away from the nude ladies, and we're going to talk about the animals. Don't turn that dial. Back in a minute. Welcome back. I'm speaking with C.J. Cook, an award-winning author, historian, and interest in the history of the South Pacific. He visits all sorts of island paradises, Guam, Pompeii, Taiwan, Palau, Bali, Fiji, New Zealand, Australia, Great Barrier Reef. He continues to explore those, goes to at least two island paradises multiple times a year, and keeps up there with what's going on in paradise. He also is a lifelong manuscript collector, and that interested me greatly. He's a member of the Manuscript Society dedicated to preserving manuscripts. So how does that dovetail into your work, CJ?
Well, I collect paintings, which are in a way are a manuscript. They're signed. And I collect Hawaiian manuscripts of the kings, Kamehameha, Lili Kalani, and others that have paper manuscripts. A lot of them don't. And some of the people that followed signed books and things of the history of Hawaiian islands. And some of the photography from Tahiti and Hawaii came into the cabinet photos and the CDBs and them that tie into it. And it forces me to go to Tahiti and Hawaii periodically to keep up with my field, you know. Somebody's got to do it. Count turtles and stuff and go there.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So also, all right, let's talk a little bit about Tyree's animals. So how did he become interested in, what was his market? How did he sell the animals? I mean, I know how he can sell the half naked Polynesian women. How does he sell his animals?
Well, he just liked animals, and he liked raptors, which are the owls and the hawks and the eagles. And this was the time of DDT and pesticides causing the animal or the eggs not to make it through, and the animals or the birds were dying, the eagles and so on. The eagles were almost, you know, the American bald eagle was almost extinct in the 60s and 70s. So he got into painting them as to bring attention to them. So he would paint them in California, mostly in studio settings where the public could come by and see him painting, and he loved doing that. And I don't think he'd get as much money. And even today, they're, you know, in the sort of the $500,000 range, not the $3,000 to $5,000 range of his ladies. And he would do them both. I have some that are on board and some that are on velvet, the exact same animal or the exact same person. And you can see the difference between them. They're just richer. Both of these artists took after Rembrandt, who would use a black background with a portrait of Pop, and the birds are the same, or the animals. So he was trying to make the, you know, the peregrine falcon and the bald eagle for people to know about them. And he did that through his art. He painted, you know, endangered animals of Africa. He never went to Africa. He wanted to go to Africa, but he never had the money to get there. But he would paint, you know, endangered critters from all of the different continents. The pangolin is on the back cover of that book. And the pangolin is a mammal that has scales that some of the cultures in Asia would kill the animal for the meat and take the scales as an aphrodisiac. And so it's a very endangered animal because it's very docile, kind of rolls up on a ball. And you can pick it up and you got it. They don't bite or anything. And in fact, it was even blamed for COVID. If you remember, one of the first things when COVID started, they blamed the pangolin from the wet markets in China. But it's a sweet animal that he loved and painted too, just to demonstrate that it was something that was very endangered. So he would do common animals, but he would also do the endangered ones. And he even wanted to have his own zoo of owls because he just loved owls. So he did quite a few of different kinds of owls in his paint. So it was in love. It was not to make money. It was just something he loved to do. He'd intermix it with the other animals of the jungle, the human type, periodically in the later years in the 70s. He died in 79.
Now, I looked all the four books up and I could order all of them on Amazon. And is that the best way for us to buy your book?
No. You can get them autographed and buy them through SouthPacificDreams.com.
There you go. Okay, forget South Amazon. Pacific,
yeah. And that'll be directly from my website. Then you can see the books and learn all about them. And I'd be glad to send them to you that way. SouthPacificDreams.
Okay, so SouthPacificDreams.com. Okay, and that's to buy CJ's books. And just another shout out of his wonderful books, you know, covering a specific type of style, tiki style. You know, growing up in Chicago, I can remember 20 Below when we go to Trader Vic's and see the torches, the tiki torches, and think, why am I even in Chicago? You know, and there was a craze. It was a thing that was done, you know, and... So, yeah, we've got wonderful books, Lee Tag, Babes, Bars, Beaches, and Black Velvet Art. It is about the story of Edgar Lee Tag, an amazing gentleman who is the father of nude Polynesian women on black velvet. Edith Bueller.
Bueller.
Yep. A colorist. So she was in 1930s. She did hand colorized black and white photography and did a beautiful job. And she was based in Hawaii, set up a shop in Hawaii in the 30s. I mean, a female entrepreneur in art. Beauty and the Beast, Flora, Fauna, and the Endangered Species of artist Ralph Burke Tyree. Another book about Tyree's beautiful endangered artists, pangolin, cotton top tamarin, ornate hawky eagle, dwarf lemur, red panda, slow loris, and the leopard in this book. And then finally, artist Tyree of the South Pacific, and a double gold medal winner, fantastic book, a U.S. World War II Marine who became an iconic artist of the tiki aesthetic and traveled Paradise Islands painting for most of his life. And here we go. And, you know, if anybody had in their past a tiki restaurant visit or anything tiki related, this is the kind of art that you would be thrilled to take a look at. And I've been talking with CJ Cook, an award-winning author who is the author of these four books, this fifth book. What's the title of the fifth book coming out, CJ?
It's Robert Lee Estridge, and he's not tiki. It's my biggest and best book as far as both the size and the amount of images, over 500 in there. He was a watercolorist, portrait, did murals, outstanding murals in the in hotels and in downtown Honolulu, and painted for many, many years, 60 of doing, and it was an illustrator for books, wrote his own books, and traveled the world. He was an adventurer. He traveled not only to, he went to Tahiti before he even came to Hawaii four times, and then wrote a book and lived with the natives in Mangareva, toured Brazil and Portugal, learned Portuguese so he could communicate there, and is a very colorful character too, but not Tahiti.
And when did he die?
He died in 75.
Okay.
So same era, a little bit later, but came through the war area too. In fact, he just left Honolulu on a Japanese boat bound for Brazil in 1941, 4 months before Pearl Harbor, and just got out of Dodge, so to speak, before the bombs started dropping.
And, you know, we think about these, you know, the kind of perceptions that we had as we were growing up, you know, the famous, you know, was it Rodgers and Hammerstein, South Pacific, and the song mm-hmm. Bali High, and, mm-hmm. you know, the way that the people of the islands were thought about. And here again, the tiki culture of the 60s, 50s, and the 60s here. This is just such an interesting and cool little niche that I was thrilled to discover about you, CJ. And thank you for being with us today.
Can I just say one other thing?
Yeah, you better.
Bali High, since you brought up Bali High. So James Michener wrote the books that revolved around South Pacific, and his Bali High was Moorea, because this island is 12 miles away from the main island of Tahiti, and that was his Bali High. That's James Michener's Bali High, this magical island. And that's the home of Lee Tag. That's where he lived. And so this goes full circle. He was there. He saw Moorea. He was interviewed. He interviews Lee Tag. And his island is Bali High. Can you
and
get
you
any
know,
better
I'm
than
thinking,
that?
What was that novel? And it's going to escape me, but it's quite a piece of literature. I mean, it's considered great literature. And it's about somebody did a group of people discovering this island where time goes backwards, et cetera. I forget the name, but it was based on the conception that was being developed in the 40s of what Polynesia was about. And so, so anyway, Richard, thank you for introducing me to CJ Cook. And everybody interested, is tell me the name of the website to get your books.
South Pacific Dreams.
There we go. Thank you, CJ, for being with us today.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it. It was really fun.
Me too. Bye.